Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading this evening, Canto 3, Chapter 7, Text 13. This is a continuation of Maitreya responding to Vidura about how the living entity becomes conditioned. Even in the presence of the personality of Godhead, who is situated within the heart of that living entity, he was the protector of his dependent devotee, or part and parcel living entity, gives sanction, or anumanta, the language of Bhagavad Gita. Upadrashta anumanta cha. These are two functions of the supersoul. Upadrashta means he oversees. He's the witness. And anumanta means he permits. To permit doesn't mean that's something that you want. Those of you that have children know about this one. You may give permission to your children to do something. It's not necessarily what you want. So, the Supersoul permits or sanctions the actions of the external energy, and the actions of the external energy are... under the Lord's direction, and they're directed in order to provide an opportunity for the living entity to try to be an enjoyer. And there's some problems with being an enjoyer. One is, we're not. We're servant. So trying to be an enjoyer, where your reality is you're a servant, it means it's illusion. To be in and permitting one to be an enjoyer, it's permitting illusion. So without the Lord's anumanta, without his sanction, there's no illusion. So we're responsible for our illusion, and the Lord is sanctioning that. Having understood how the living entity becomes conditioned, then there's a clue to how to become free from conditioning. That's to withdraw that intention to be the enjoyer and resume the position of factual position, the healthy position, the natural position of being a servant. So that's what this verse is about this evening. Specifically, it's about the senses. What's the role of the senses in becoming free from conditioning? The verse describes engaging the senses fully in the service of the master of the senses. What's that verse? From the definition of bhakti from the Narada Pancharatra. Very good. So part of what we were discussing was upadis. Then the other part is what the senses do. So rejecting the false identification in the form of the designations of this body and mind as to what my real identity is, and then taking up one's real identity. Rejecting the false and accepting the factual. The factual is we're servants of the Supreme Lord, and we demonstrate that by engaging our senses in the service of the master of the senses. And that's a definition of bhaktir. Bhaktir uchite. Bhakti is said to be that. So here's the Bhagavatam verse expressing same idea. I'll read the Sanskrit. Yada means when. Indriya, the senses. Uparama, we know what Rama is. What's Rama? Pleasure. Uparama, the highest pleasure. Completely satisfied, completely satiated. The senses are satiated only when they're engaged in the service of the master of the senses, and not otherwise. They're insatiable. Yada indriya uparama ata. Ata means thus. Drashtri atmani. There's this drashta again. Atmani is the super soul. The soul of the soul. That's nice. There's a soul, and within the soul, there's a super soul. It's transcendental. One god brother of mine was sharing with me that he asked Prabhupada, can you explain, it says the soul is 1/10,000th the size of a tip of a hair? So small. And in the second canto of Bhagavatam, it says the yogis meditate on the form of super soul that's the size of a thumb. But that which is the size of a thumb is inside that which is 1/10,000th the tip of a hair. So how is that possible? You know, the math doesn't work. And Prabhupada just repeated that the soul is 1/10,000th the tip of a hair, and the super soul, the size of a thumb, is inside the heart of that soul. So the dialogue went on. It was a room conversation. The devotee thought Prabhupada didn't understand his question. So he asked it again, and Prabhupada gave the same answer. What is the problem? One of his servants, personal servants, Shruta Kirti, wrote his diary of, or his experiences with Srila Prabhupada from his diary, in the title of the book, What's the Problem? What is the problem? So it's transcendental. The Lord is transcendentally, you can't measure him. Because he can be anor aniyangsa manusmaradyaha. He can be smaller than the smallest and bigger than the biggest at the same time. Not just, okay, first I'll be really small, and then I'll be really big, and then I'll be really small. He's at the same time bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest. Huh? It's beyond material calculation. It's a spiritual big and a spiritual small, and to say this size is just to give us some idea. Okay, there's the thumb, there's the heart. At the same time, as he can manifest within the heart of Dhruva and then suddenly be in right in front of him. And so on. He can be manifest in multiple forms simultaneously. In the Govardhan Leela, one of the features of Govardhan Leela that I particularly relish is that there's three forms of Krishna shown all at once in that Leela. You want to hear what those three forms are? There's Krishna, the son of Nanda Maharaj, Nanda Nandana. And there's the form of Hari, who's so big that he eats all the anukut offerings that the Vrijbasis bring before him. All those ingredients that were for the Indra Yajna, Krishna instructs Nanda Maharaj to have the brahmanas take all those ingredients and prepare nice offerings. And they brought the nice offerings. Stacks of rotis and rice and vegetables and cakes and sweet rice and all kinds of dairy products, and placed them all before Govardhan Hill, and just to show the devotees that Krishna wasn't just talking like a small boy. Govardhan Hill is Krishna. He manifested a giant form. Hari. Krishna paid his obeisances before Hari. And who is the third form? Govardhan Hill. Govardhan Hill is not different than Krishna. So there's Govardhan Hill, there's Lord Hari, and there's Krishna, each of a different form. But they're all Krishna. Which one is Krishna? They're all Krishna. Simultaneously. Then Lord Hari disappeared. But he can appear in thousands and thousands and thousands. Like the Brahma Vimohan Leela. How many cows did Nanda Maharaj have? 4 lakhs of cows. This is when they were small. Krishna was just 7. Can you let them open the door and come in? Can we move forward a little bit so there's a little space? Very good. Look at that. Okay, so anyway, Krishna manifested himself as many calves and cowherd boys as there were simultaneously. But Krishna, that's not a big deal. He can manifest anything. He is everything. He can manifest anything. So he's manifested within the heart of the living being as the drashta, antaryami, or here it's atmani. Our capacity to see, this is in the second canto, our capacity to see is dependent upon the Lord seeing. So to facilitate the conditioned soul seeing, there's a whole chapter describing the universal form sees and so the living entity can see. The universal form hears and so the living entity can hear. We hear, etc., see. Our senses are operative because the Lord is seeing. Say, the converse is, without the Lord seeing, we can't see. Without the Lord hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, our senses are this dull matter, gross or subtle, because there is only not only a gross sense like an ear, but the sense of hearing. It's subtle. You can take this ear off and put another ear on, or this eye and put another eye in. You know, it's like a machine part. Put in an alternator, take out an alternator, put in another one. It's a machine part. So that the seeing potency is subtle. But for that subtle potency to be effective, it depends upon Krishna seeing or hearing or smelling. Or our sensory capacity is empowered by the Supreme Lord, even to the point of being an illusion. Isn't that what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita? He's situated in the heart within the heart of every living being, and from him comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. Like, it's maybe easy to understand how remembrance comes from him, but forgetfulness also comes from him. our ability to forget something. We couldn't have the ability to forget something if it wasn't for Krishna giving us the ability to forget, or the ability to remember, or the ability to do anything. Ability to exist. Although that's eternal, nonetheless, that's also dependent. We're dependent beings. That's who we are. We're servants. So when the concentration of the senses, this is bhakti, because that's from the previous verse, if you remember, Bhagavad Bhakti Yogena. So that's the mitigating process of the sufferings. So it means engaging the senses. And when the senses are immersed, uparama, completely satisfied in the object, Krishna, the super soul, who is pare, in transcendence, and he's Hari, he's the supreme personality of Godhead, then viliyante tadakklesha, the senses become completely absorbed in the Supreme Lord. At that time, kleshas, what does klesha mean? Adiatmaka klesha, adibhautika klesha, adidaivaka klesha. Klesha means misery, suffering. Tada klesha sam suptasyeva krishna shaha. Supta, not sukta, but supta, susupta. It's a state. There are three states of consciousness that are described: awake, sleep, and deep sleep. Susupti is the deep sleep, like the living entity when in the body of Mahavishnu during the time of cosmic annihilation, or the consciousness of the living entity after death while in the womb of the next mother for some 7-month period. They're in this deep sleep. The consciousness is there, but deep state of deep sleep, or like anesthesia. Sometimes in hospitals, when the medical doctors are doing some operation or some kind of procedure, they administer anesthesia. There's like a branch of medicine, anesthesiology. They're like, all they do is they just put people to sleep. They get paid nicely for it. Because there can be complications if it's not done properly. So that's a state of consciousness. You're not dreaming. And you're not awake, but you're not out of existence. You're just under anesthesia, deep sleep. So that's what this verse is saying. Sam suptasyeva Krishna shaha. When the senses are satisfied, uparama, in the seer dash super soul, the personality of Godhead, and merge in him, completely absorbed in him, in other words, all miseries, klesha, are completely vanquished as after a sound sleep. So that's the mitigating process. The process of bhakti includes the proper use of the senses. The proper use of the senses is full absorption in service to the master of the senses. And there are various forms of that. So in the purport, Prabhupada is discussing what happens in material life when that's not in place. The quivering, same metaphor as before, he's continuing with that. you remember from the morning class this morning and yesterday evening's class, the moon in the sky and the moon on the surface of the water being reflected because the wind, the water moves, and because the water moves, the reflection of the moon is quivering. So that's the mind, is like the reflecting surface. But then there's also the senses. They're also quivering. They're quivering in the sense that they want to enjoy. And there is such and such object, something you want to see, smell, touch, taste, or hear. So the senses then quiver due to the attraction for sense enjoyment. So mitigation of suffering, that brings suffering. The expectation of happiness, yehi sam sparsha ja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. So I quote this verse a lot because it's like ABC. We want bhoga and we get dukkha. We want happiness and we get distress. We want to enjoy and we get punched in the nose. And we keep doing it, you know, like donkeys. You just like endlessly keep doing it. So that quivering metaphor is used just very quickly. Then being frustrated with that program, looking for release, so by negation looking to stop the senses. And you can't stop the senses. They just need higher engagement. And that higher engagement is bhakti. And it's not an option. There's not another position. Sense enjoyment, impersonal merging, higher engagement. These are the options that are laid out. And the one that the verse is recommending and the purport is confirming. Engagement in devotional service, senses serving the master of the senses. Here's the purport. The quivering of the living entity, as described above, is due to the senses. Since the entire material existence is meant for sense gratification, the senses are the medium of material activities, and they cause the quivering of the steady soul. So we were blaming the mind before, now it's the senses. But they're partners in crime. He did it. No, he did it. The senses don't operate independent of the mind and vice versa. The mind is where the information or the sensory input comes into the central switchboard, so the central switchboard is depending upon that information of the senses. But then the mind is the sixth sense. It's the composite of all the five senses and where desire and conceptions of life reside. So it's like a cesspool. And then there's little streams that feed the cesspool. Therefore, the senses are to be detached from all material activities. That's the quivering material part. Now comes the impersonal part. According to the impersonalists, the senses are stopped from work by merging the soul into the super soul, Brahman. The devotee, however, does not stop the material senses from acting, but they engage their transcendental senses in the service of the transcendence, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In either case, the activity of the senses in the material field are to be stopped by cultivation of knowledge. And if possible, they can be engaged in the service of the Lord. The senses are transcendental in nature. So speaking of the, you know, the machine part, like, you know, the senses, the ear, the tongue, touch, smell, sight. That's the machine part. There's the subtle sense. But there's also the soul. There, the whole machine is driven by the soul. Take the driver out, the machine doesn't work. You can have a headlight to your car. It's nighttime. The headlight is turned on. But if the headlight doesn't work, you can put another headlight. Because the system, the electrical system from your switch, your dashboard on your, you know, press the button and the circuit is set up, and so if the light bulb is good, the headlight is showing. But take the driver out, you can have a good electrical system and a good bulb, and nothing's going to happen. The car just sits there. The soul also has transcendental senses. So to engage the transcendental senses of the soul means the subtle senses and the gross senses, they're all in turn engaged in devotional service. It's practical engagement of the transcendental senses in the service of transcendence, the Supreme Lord. The senses are transcendental in nature, but their activities become polluted when contaminated by matter. Become contaminated by matter, it's been explained, because we desire not to be the servant, but to be the master. Same senses, same object, we become contaminated. Same senses, same object in devotion, we become purified. Like eating and working and singing and dancing and whatever. In devotion, it's purifying. And minus devotion, with minus thought of pleasing Krishna's senses, it's contaminating. Same activity. We have to treat the senses to cure them of the material disease, not stop them from acting as suggested by the impersonalists. In Bhagavad Gita 2:59, it is said that one ceases all material activities only when satisfied by contact with a better engagement. By contact with a better engagement. Who knows that verse? 2:59? Vishayavi nivartante niraha shadehinam. Say it loud so everyone can hear. The last part? Raso Varjam Raso Pyasya Pram Drishtvanda Vartate. The material side, the spiritual side. Vishaya, sense enjoyment. And to cease from sense enjoyment just by restraining the senses, it's incomplete. It's grossly inadequate, insufficient. But by engaging with a higher taste, then that lower engagement of sense gratification is easily terminated. Consciousness is active by nature and cannot be stopped from working. Artificially, a mischievous child. Do we have any mischievous children around? Artificially stopping a mischievous child is not the real remedy. The child must be given some better engagement so that he will automatically stop causing mischief. In the same way, the mischievous activities of the senses can be stopped only by better engagement in relation with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then he describes the process of bhakti. The eyes are engaged in seeing the beautiful form of the Lord. The tongue engaged in tasting prasad or remnants of the foodstuff offered to the Lord. The ears are engaged in hearing his glories. The hands engaged in cleansing the temple of the Lord. The legs engaged in visiting his temples. Or, when all the senses are engaged in transcendental variegatedness, then only can the transcendental senses become, here's that word again, satiated, uparama, and eternally free from material engagement. The Lord, as the Supersoul, residing in everyone's heart, and as the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the transcendental world, far beyond the material creation, is the seer, drashta, of all our activities. Last sentence, like summary. Our activities must be so transcendentally saturated, uparama, that the Lord will be kind enough to look upon us favorably and engage us in his transcendental service. Then only can the senses be satisfied completely and be no longer troubled by material attraction. So we got a bonus. The question by Vidura wasn't what's the mitigating process, but he wanted to know how it's possible the living entity can become covered. But as mentioned, when you understand how we become covered, we can understand it become uncovered. But there's an investing of covering capacity or covering potency within Maya. And the Lord can, just like that, just Maya, leave him alone. Boom. Or Maya, do your thing. You have some service to do. Yaya samohito jiva atmanam trigodatma. Just as Rupa Goswami wrote that the desire for sense gratification and the desire for liberation can be compared to witches and something else. There's a nice story about this. When Rupa Goswami was comprising nectar devotion or bhakti rasamrita sindhu, he was residing in Vrindavan. In fact, one of the places that he was principally engaged in writing nectar devotion or bhakti rasamrita sindhu is at Ter Kadamba. Any of you who have been to Ter Kadamba? It's a transcendentally sublime, wonderful place. Very simple. Not like big. It's very simple. It's in between where Krishna's residence was at Nandagram and the place where Srimati Radharani lived when she was supposedly married to her so-called husband Abhimanyu. Yavat. So there's a road in between the two, and at the end of the day Krishna would bring his cows back to the Goshal at Nanda Maharaj place. And it's, you know, Nandagram is up on the hill, so the Goshal was down at the bottom of the hill. And Ter Kadamba is the place where Krishna would climb up on top of one of the Kadamba trees and look out and make sure all of the 900,000 cows of Nanda Maharaj made it back. Up on top of a Kadamba tree, and he would call out the cows by name. Could you imagine being a cow and having Krishna call your name? Ooh. And if one of them was missing, Krishna would go and find them. But they didn't want to trouble Krishna, so they would come. But sometimes Krishna would have to go and find them. And it was in that Kadamba grove There's a whole grove of kadamba trees, therefore called Ter Kadamba. It was a meeting place, a nighttime meeting place. Everyone was asleep. Krishna would leave Nandagram. Radharani would come from Yavata and meet at Ter Kadamba. Secret. Very, very sweet and special place. So it was there that Rupa Goswami kept a bhajan kutir, and there that he was writing a good portion of Nectar Devotion or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So at some point in time, Ballabha Acharya, the principal Acharya and contemporary of the Pushti Marg. Those of you that are from Gujarat, you know what is the Pushti Marg. From another bona fide line of disciplic succession, he was residing in Vrindavan also as a worshipper of Krishna. And he had great regard for Rupa Goswami. And Rupa Goswami requested Ballabha, please read Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and if you find something in it that you feel is just not appropriate, please let me know. You know, can you help me with my editing, more or less. So he found something one day where there was this reference to witches, that sense gratification and impersonal monism are like witches. And his comment to Rupa Goswami is, that's a little extreme. You know, tone it down a little bit. Something like that. So Rupa Goswami said, let me consider this. Thank you for this comment. Jiva Goswami heard about it. So he went to Ballabhacharya and said, here's all the scriptural references. It's exactly like it says in the scriptural references. Rupa Goswami can't possibly make a mistake. And Ballabhacharya was, I see the references. It makes sense. Okay, very good. Because they're like witches. What's the effect of witches? They spook you and haunt you and make you crazy. Sometimes, like Putin, they eat you or something. Drink your blood. But, you know, cause trouble and disturbance and do those types of things. So the material energy, thinking of the material energy as enjoyable, is that thought is like being harassed by a witch. Makes you some mohita, very bewildered. Yaya, some mohito jiva. That's what the external energy does. So it's appropriate. When Rupa Goswami heard that Jiva Goswami had confronted Ballabha in this way, he wasn't happy. He said, philosophically, the conclusion that you established is fine. But he's a great Vaishnava. And I asked him to do some service, and he was trying to do some service. It wasn't criticism of a Vaishnava. He was trying to help me compose Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu very nicely. This isn't so good, what you've just done. But Jiva Goswami, from his perspective, he was just defending the honor of his Guru Maharaj, thinking he's being criticized. But how can he be criticized? He's flawless. He's right. That was one of those transcendental things. Honoring his spiritual master. And his spiritual master wanting to honor another. These things are going on. And once under the influence of a witch or a ghost or some spell or something, how do you get free unless there's a person who is free who removes the spell? So that's the effect of, like the verse that we read this morning or quoted this morning, Vyasadeva therefore compiled this Satvata Samhita, this Srimad Bhagavatam, so that we can become free from that deluding influence. That is, being once again engaged in hearing, chanting, remembering, serving, worshipping, tasting, smelling, walking to the temple, engaged in devotional activities with the senses under the guidance of the Bhagavatam and the person and the book Bhagavat, and thus becoming freed from material suffering, the material conception of life, and restoring the proper spiritual conception of life. What a relief. It's the ultimate medicine. It's the medicine so you don't need medicine anymore. No more illnesses, no more material existence. That's the Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, any comments or questions? You've been a quiet group during this visit. It's not normal. Yes? Okay. Let me restate your question in different language. The role of Shuddha Bhakti is simply engaging in service to Krishna. Correspondingly, what's the role of Varnashram? Does it have a place also in pure devotional service? That's your question.
Under guidance of a pure devotee?
Sure. Let me answer your question with a question. What did Krishna say to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita in relation to Varnashram under the most qualified of all spiritual masters, Krishna himself? What did Krishna say? Arjuna, you have your ashram, you have your varna. You're to engage in your duty. And always think of me. So, daivi varnashram. So, in the talks between Lord Chaitanya and Ramananda Roy, Ramananda Roy was asked by Lord Chaitanya, what's the goal of life and the means to achieve it? So the first one of the five verses that he suggested initially, the first one is Varnashram, engaging in your prescribed duties. Without engaging in your prescribed duties, there's no way to satisfy the Supreme Lord. By engaging in prescribed duties, you're satisfying the Supreme Lord. That's the goal of life. And he quoted the verse from Vishnu Purana. Varnashrama charavata purushena parakpuman arajate. So one worships the Supreme Lord by engaging in prescribed duties. Well, Lord Chaitanya said that's external. But the verse that he accepted was stane stitak, stay in your position. That means Varnashram is included. Because what's your position? In the material world, it's guna and karma, quality and work, or your Varnashram situation, your psychophysical nature. Stane stita. So engage in that. As Krishna was telling Arjuna, you have your duty to give protection. But always think of me at the same time. So that's with proper guidance, how to do both. what's your proper duty and how to always think of Krishna while so doing. And it's based primarily on, both are based primarily on the hearing process. It's the guidance of the how-to part. Then there's the relationship, establishing the relationship. Sambandhagyan, establishing relationship through the medium of service, starting with hearing. So the answer to your question is yes, it has its role. Another brilliant example of this, brilliant in the sense that it's like, it's stark, it's so bright, that kind of brilliant, is Brahma Samhita, where Lord Brahma has achieved pure, full Krishna consciousness, but he still has a desire to do something. In his case, it's create a universe. Now, we may not have that desire. We have a desire to do something according to our nature. So how do we put the two together? And the final verses of Brahma Samhita explain it. That we combine what's the term? Gona something bhakti. We combine our nature, our tendencies with the hearing and chanting, or the direct processes of bhakti, primarily with hearing and chanting. So under guidance, we hear and chant, and under guidance we engage our propensities. And what Lord Vishnu says to Lord Brahma is by so doing, the engagement is as liberating as the direct activities of bhakti. That's good news, isn't it? But we have to do it properly. Yes. Yes.
So will it not be an obstruction when we are trying to engage in devotional service?
It can be. That is to say, the obstruction that you're mentioning is the tendency of the senses so engaged to still have this I want to enjoy thing going on. So let's take prasadam. Oh, this is good prasadam. And I like to enjoy tasting nice things, and so you overeat. Oh. And I can't chant nicely, and I don't feel well, and so I guess I have to eat, I have to control my senses with not eating too much. So, but purification leads to more purification. So that yes, there's risk, and you can say with other things, without going into the whole scenario, the other things can also be at risk. Therefore, that one should be vigilant when engaging the senses in service to Krishna, that we're not simply caught up in indulging ourselves in the name of devotional service. Prabhupada's example or metaphor is a razor, very sharp instrument that's very good, good for shaving your head too. So, but you have to be very attentive when using a razor because you're inattentive and you've got a bloody mess. So one must be very attentive when engaging in devotional service, engaging the senses in service to Krishna. Therefore, the attentiveness factor is part of the quality of hearing and part of the quality of the relationship that one has from that source one is hearing from, or with that source one is hearing from. That relationship should be strong, so it'll help me be attentive. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Shrila Prabhupada Ki Jai.